This morning I'm resuming my series of sermons as I've been preaching through the book of Isaiah. We laid it aside during the Christmas season to consider the coming of Jesus Christ, and we return now to the book of Isaiah. I'll read the first 10 verses of Isaiah chapter 21. Please listen to God's word. The burden against the wilderness of the sea. As whirlwinds in the south pass through, so it comes from the desert, from a terrible land. A distressing vision is declared to me. The treacherous dealer deals treacherously, and the plunderer plunders. Go up, O Elam, besiege, O Media. All its sighing I have made to cease. Therefore, my loins are filled with pain. Pangs have taken hold of me like the pangs of a woman in labor. I was distressed when I heard it. I was dismayed when I saw it. My heart wavered. Fearfulness frightened me. The night for which I longed, he turned into fear for me. Prepare the table, set a watchman in the tower, eat and drink. Arise, you princes, anoint the shield. For thus has the Lord said to me, go, set a watchman, let him declare what he sees. And he saw a chariot with a pair of horsemen, a chariot of donkeys and a chariot of camels. And he listened earnestly with care. Then he cried, a lion, my Lord! I stand continually on the watchtower in the daytime. I have sat at my post every night, and look, here comes a chariot of men with a pair of horsemen. Then he answered and said, Babylon is fallen, and all the carved images of her gods he has broken to the ground. O my threshing and the grain of my floor, that which I have heard from the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, I have declared to you. This passage sits in the midst of Isaiah's prophecy against the nations that surrounded Israel. We've noticed in the chapters before that Judah was in a period of decline, that the glory of Jerusalem and the temple and all that Solomon had built and David had established, all of those things were in a great degree of decline. There were still points of light in Israel's history. There were still points where God's might and power shone through and where the prophets of the Lord and the kings followed after God. But for the most part, Jerusalem's light was fading. They faced a number of trials, and those trials came from within and from without. And the chapters that have preceded this one especially touch on the nations around Jerusalem. So we've seen prophecies against Egypt and Syria and Ethiopia, Moab, Philistia, Assyria. They've all been the subjects of Isaiah's prophecies. This chapter concerns Babylon. Or, as Isaiah calls it here poetically, the wilderness of the sea. I want you to know that at this point, Babylon was just a province of Assyria. They were not a world power at this point. Later, they would rise and eclipse Assyria. They would become an even greater power than Assyria was, that was the most powerful foe that Jerusalem faced at this point. And in fact, Babylon would be the one that would come and would break down the walls of Jerusalem, would destroy the temple, would take the people away into captivity under the famous king Nebuchadnezzar. Much like the previous chapters, this prophecy serves a purpose that helped the people in Isaiah's day to understand what God was doing, but a purpose that also eclipses Isaiah's day to help us understand the Lord's dealings with his people in all times. It's especially that purpose that we will come to understand as we see how Isaiah was speaking, how God was speaking to his own children in this day of distress. The point that is going to be made is that the Lord calls us to faith by communicating assurance to his children in the midst of affliction. He calls us to faith, to trust him in the midst of our trials, because the Lord is communicating assurance. There are three things that I'm going to draw out of this passage. First, I'd like to set this passage in its historical setting so that we can understand it. Second, I want you to note a very important New Testament quote of this passage. And then finally, we'll come to consider the purpose of the prophecy that calls us to faith. First of all, the historical setting. Isaiah proclaims and prophesies the fall of Babylon even before Babylon stood up. It's very interesting that as a prophet, Isaiah looks down towards not just one step away from where they were at that time currently, but he looks 10 to 15 to 20 years down the road. I imagine that in fighter tactics at the Air Force, that they train the pilots to look not at just the threat that is right in front of them, but at what is going to happen 3 or 4 or 5 moves down the road so that they can anticipate. Well, Isaiah does something like that. God does something like that. He anticipates what the children of God are going to undergo, and he addresses it even before it comes to pass. We find out about the fall of Babylon in the book of Daniel, and there are some very striking fulfillments of this passage in the fall of Babylon. I'd like you to note them this morning. Verses 1 and 2 describe an enemy coming against Babylon from the south like a whirlwind, coming across the desert like a terrible from a terrible land. And God names that enemy that would bring down Babylon. He calls Elam and Media to rise up and to invade Babylon. In the book of Daniel, we find that it is the nations, the combined nations of the Medes and the Persians. Now, Persian is another name for Elam. In this passage, it's the Medes and the Persians that rise up. See, God's not only telling about Babylon, who has yet to stand up, but he's telling about the Medes and the Persian, which would be the next dominant world power that would bring down Babylon. Isaiah describes them as coming from a terrible land. And historians describe how the Medes and the Persians sent their soldiers to train in the desert land, a place that where their soldiers were hardened to physical difficulties and to trials, and their soldiers were known to be ruthless, to be a foe that you would not want to face, literally coming from a terrible land. Those armies came against Babylon like a whirlwind, raised up by God to do his work. In addition to having fierce soldiers, the Medes and the Persians had the help of traitors inside the walls. Again, historians help us to understand what happened. Historians record that there were two great officers in the nation that were very close to the king of Babylon. And the king at that time was Nebuchadnezzar's son, Belshazzar. And they were very close to him. And knowing the city well and being known by the city, they were able to gain access and to let soldiers into the city and to lead a company of covert soldiers in to assassinate King Belshazzar. Isaiah says that the treacherous dealer deals treacherously, and the plunderer plunders. See, Babylon was overthrown not just from without, but also from within. Verses 3 and 4 describe the dread that came upon King Belshazzar before this terrible night. In fact, it's that very night that this terror came upon them, that he is filled with dread and with pain. Daniel records the night that Babylon fell. King Belshazzar had proclaimed a great feast, and he gathered around him his officials, his generals, and they ate and they drank. They prepared a table in front of them. And upon that table, they set out some of the spoils of their war. One of the spoils that they used were the golden vessels of the temple of the Lord from Jerusalem that Nebuchadnezzar had captured in warfare. And they used these golden vessels that were used to worship the one true God, and they used them to make offerings to their idols. And in the midst of this great and glorious feast, in the most powerful nation that the world had known up to that point, there appeared a hand on the wall that was writing strange things. We're not exactly sure what he saw, if there was a physical manifestation or if there was something projected on the wall, but somehow, miraculously, the hand of God was shown writing things on the wall. Now that put a little damper on the party. And the king wanted to know what was going on. And it begins a process of his trying to find out. Listen to the way Daniel describes it in Daniel chapter 5. In the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his hips were loosened and his knees knocked against each other. That's somebody who is really, really scared. There was once that I was watching a thunderstorm come in to the city, and I was looking out the window. I was in high school at this time, watching out the window, kind of bent out, looking out the window, and a bolt of lightning hit, it seemed like, right across the street. The next thing I knew, I was on the floor because my legs had given way underneath me. Well, that's what King Belshazzar felt. His legs gave way underneath him. We could describe it in many ways. And Isaiah describes fear and trembling and pain in the gut that had come upon those who saw this vision. The fear of the Lord smote the enemies of God as God proclaimed his judgment against them. Well, Belshazzar looks for someone to interpret, and eventually he finds Daniel, a prophet of God who is in captivity. I encourage you to read this with your family. That's a fascinating account. Daniel comes and he interprets the words that are written on the wall. They're interpreted as saying, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. You have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. And that very night, Babylon fell and Belshazzar was killed. That very night, God rose up and acted. Verse 5 in Isaiah 21 seems to continue the description of that night. The table prepared for the feast so that all of Babylon could eat and feast. And a watchman was set on the tower to keep watch, just in case any armies would dare to come against this great power. And what did the watchman find? Verses 6 through 9 describe it. He saw a chariot and a pair of horsemen. two chariots, one led by donkeys, one by camels, probably representing those two nations of the Medes and the Persians coming against Babylon. The watchman cries out his warning, "A lion, my lord!" In other words, the enemy is at the gate. He has watched and he has watched, and he sees the enemy. But by then it was too late. Through treachery, Belshazzar was killed. The king was felled. And the invading armies were led into the city, and Babylon came down. The only one that would reply to the watchman are the leaders outside. Babylon is fallen, is fallen. It's the taunt of the enemy describing this great nation. Babylon is fallen, and all the carved images of her gods he has broken to the ground. You remember that in Hebrew that the repetition of a word intensifies what's going on. We had the holiness of God given three times. Well, here is an instance of the use of two words repeated. Babylon is fallen, fallen. In other words, it is utterly destroyed by the enemies. God proclaimed, even before it took place, that Babylon was in his hand and would fall before him. In a striking way, the New Testament quotes this passage. It quotes it twice. And both quotations come in the book of Revelation. Because of its placement, you may begin to guess at the purpose of this passage. You may begin to guess at why the New Testament would look at this passage and quote it again. It's quoted in Revelation chapter 14, verses 6 through 8, and then in Revelation 18, verses 1 through 8. I'll read just one of those passages, representative of both of them. They are both a proclamation of the judgment of the Lord against Babylon. This is what Revelation 14, verses 6 through 8 says. "Then I saw another angel flying in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to those who dwell on the earth, to every nation, tribe, tongue, and people, saying with a loud voice, 'Fear God and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment has come, and worship Him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water.' And another angel followed, saying, 'Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she has made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication.'" The churches who received the letter of the book of Revelation needed to hear this message. They faced much of the same type of trial and much of the same temptation that the people of God in Isaiah's day faced. They faced intense persecution. Some of them went to their deaths in the Colosseum, facing lions. Others were set on fire by the Caesars, by the kings of Rome. The non-Christian institutions, the non-Christian nations threatened to swallow up the church, much like Babylon seemed to swallow up the people of God in Isaiah's day. But like in Isaiah's day, God says that He still rules, that He is the one who is in control of this situation. And as He judged Babylon in the Old Testament, God proclaimed to the New Testament churches a judgment on those that were coming against them in their day. Can you start to begin to understand a timeless message to God's people that comes in this passage? Verse 10 helps us in a special way, back in Isaiah chapter 21, helps us to understand God's purpose in proclaiming this judgment. The Lord speaks directly to his people through Isaiah. Oh, my threshing and the grain of my floor, that which I have heard from the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, I have declared to you. As I said, these words reveal the purpose of the revelation. God's purpose was to call his own people to faith by assuring them that he was in charge, that he had not let go of the work of his hand, that he had not forgotten what he had promised to do. For the Israelites, their hope was that the Lord would not only deliver them from a physical enemy, but the hope of the promise of God had always been tied up and bound up with the promise of the coming of Jesus Christ. The promises included that the Messiah would come, who would be a king who would sit on David's throne. So just how was that going to happen if Jerusalem was fallen? How could it happen that a king in David's line would rise up if David's line was wiped out? Well, God promised. Because of his promise, he could say to the Israelites in Isaiah's day that he has not forgotten that promise. That even though you go through a devastating defeat and you go into captivity, God will keep his promise. God will keep his word. The church in the New Testament faced a similar persecution from Rome. In this case, some died. Others were deprived of home and food and water, suffering even death. Nevertheless, God rules. He rules all things. Because of that, we can discern a timeless message for the church in every age. We, like the Jews and like the New Testament church, are called to faith. We're called to faith based on the assurance that God gives, that he will never leave us or forsake us, that he will provide us deliverance, especially deliverance from the enemy of sin and Satan and death. Look again at verse 10. O my threshing and the grain of my floor. The commentator Matthew Henry draws five special promises from these words that I'd like to develop this morning. They're promises that will strengthen our faith. They're the promises of God that are the foundation for the trust and the faith which he calls us to exercise. First of all, God calls you, his church, my threshing. Just underline the first word, my, there. God calls you mine. You belong to God. That simple, small word communicates great blessing to us. Think of the security that you find when your parents pull you up onto their lap and they rock you in their arms and they say, my baby, my child. For those of you who are older, maybe you can't sit on your parents' lap any longer, but there's still security when your father and your mother put their arm around your shoulder, take your hand, and they say, my son, my daughter. And they pray for you, or they pray with you, and you know the love that comes from them when they name you mine. God names you as belonging to him. Mine, says God. This is what Jesus Christ came to accomplish. He came to redeem God's children and to stamp you with God's own name. We receive an inheritance in Jesus Christ, that we belong to God. He calls you mine. Do you believe that? This is where God calls you to exercise faith. He calls you to recognize that stamp that He places on you, and to accept the love of God in Jesus Christ. What child would pull away from his parents and walk away? Well, we wouldn't do that, would we? We cling to the love of our parents. And so, by faith, God calls us to cling to Him. Secondly, the church is God's threshing. In other words, we are God's harvest. Think of the church as the end product for which God is working. In other words, when you plant a garden, what do you expect? Well, you don't just go out and plant a tomato plant and then forget about it. If you're like me, you go out and you weed it, and you water it, and you're waiting for something. You're waiting for that nice, ripe, juicy tomato to fall off into your hand, that you go in and you cut and you eat. The harvest is here. That's why you plant a garden, for the harvest. And that's what God calls you as church. He calls you His harvest, His threshing. That means that there is value that He sees in you, and He is working all things towards this end, that you would belong to Him and be His harvest. Again, we see Jesus Christ at work. Jesus came to seek and to save that which is lost. And He sends out His disciples into the world to gather a harvest, to gather those that would be worshipers of God, those that would be drawn into His glorious presence, both in this life and in that which is to come, drawn to worship this great God. Do you believe that? Do you believe that you are God's harvest? That you are the pinnacle of His work, that He is drawing you into His glorious presence? He's calling you to exercise faith, even in the midst of affliction, to see the value that He places on you. Thirdly, believers are God's grain. And I think at this point that Isaiah has in mind the difference between the wheat and the chaff. When grain was harvested it's still harvested this way. The wheat has to be cut and brought in, and the kernel, the good stuff of the wheat, is bound up on a stalk and covered in a husk. And that good kernel of grain has to be broken out of it and then divided between what is good and what is kept, and what is worthless, what is the chaff, and is blown away. When God calls you His grain, it seems to be emphasizing the difference there, that which has been broken out and is separated from that which is worthless. Think again of what Jesus Christ describes in His parables in the New Testament. He describes the mixture that is in the visible church in this life, a mixture between believers and unbelievers. But the Lord knows who are His. The Lord knows those who are His grain. And He will separate eventually between the wheat and the chaff, the sheep and the goats. And He will bring rewards to those who belong to Jesus Christ, a reward of everlasting righteousness and eternal life. One day we will be gathered together, and we know the blessing of that even now, that we are called out of the world to belong to Him. Well, again, let me ask, do you believe that? Do you believe that the Lord has separated you to Himself? Do you believe that He has called you to be separate from unrighteousness and from the deeds of wickedness? That leads us to live in a certain way, putting off the old man and putting on the new because we belong to God. Fourthly, the grain is threshed. I've described it in the Old Testament terms that the head of grain is cut off and it's brought in, and then it's crushed, it's beaten, so that it is the good kernel is broken out of what's worthless. And Matthew Henry says, I think very importantly, that the grain of God's floor must expect to be threshed by afflictions and persecutions. See, that good end that God has in mind has a process leading to that good end. And that process is a process that uses the afflictions of this life to help you to put off what is old and useless. It's a process that by suffering, God teaches us to persevere in faith. In 1 Peter chapter 4, the Apostle Peter says, "Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you, but rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's suffering, that when His glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy. If you are reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you, for the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. On their part He is blasphemed, but on your part He is glorified. Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in this matter." The grain is threshed. Do you believe that? In the midst of your affliction, cry out to God in a way that understands that the Lord is using it to work your good and His own glory. He has a good purpose in mind, and He calls you to that. And finally, God is the one who does the threshing. This is a similar point as the one that has just gone before. That means that whatever hardship that we face, whatever difficulty, whatever trial that we suffer, it comes under God's control. When Babylon defeated Jerusalem, did that mean that now Babylon was God? Of course not. When Rome raged against the early Christians, did that mean that Rome was God? No, it doesn't. For that matter, both Babylon and Rome have gone away into the pages of history, but the church still stands. That's because God still stands. And God was not overthrown by Babylon, by Rome, by any trial that you care to name in history or in your life currently, or anything that you will face ever in your life. It can never overcome the work of God's hands. Never. Do you believe that? By His assurances, God is calling you to believe. God is calling you to faith that His assurances stand. What a timely message for the people of God today. You, as the church of Jesus Christ, you belong to Him. He looks on you as His valuable harvest, that which he is drawing into his presence to worship him both now and forever. As such, he will never leave you or forsake you. He will guide you through trials so that your faith may be strengthened, so that your faith, which is more precious than gold, which perishes, may be purified, so that your faith may be shown as genuine, resulting in the praise and honor and glory of our great God, who through Jesus Christ has delivered us from sin and temptation. God calls you to believe it. God calls you to faith. And he gives you assurances to strengthen that faith. As the harvest of the Lord, I pray that you would both know and believe these promises he has given. Let's respond by singing to the Lord Psalm 72, Selection C. It's a psalm that is described as it's descriptive of the harvest. Describes the Lord's planting on the hills that grows. It grows so full that the heads of wheat are bending over with the weight of the harvest. It's a harvest that the Lord is at work bringing in. And it closes with a blessing to him. Blessed be God who does this. As God's harvest, let's praise him. Let's stand and sing Psalm 72, Selection C.